everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, February 20th, 2023, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And it's looking like there may not be a new episode next week. We're still trying to figure that out, but I am about to travel to the Middle East to do a little bit of relief work and trying to coordinate everything along with, you know, working on my psychology internship, working on my dissertation, doing this upcoming travel, coordinating with a lot of different schedules. We may be able to get a new episode to you each week, but we may have to skip 1 week. And if that's the case, I apologize in advance, but we will be back before you know it. I do want to thank those of you who keep Talk Nerdy churning, keep it going, help pay me, help pay my assistant, help make sure that we can do this. It's obviously something that we do both out of the kindness of our hearts and the interest and the excitement, but also it helps to offset because many of you are just really, really kind and you contribute to the show on an episodic basis. If you want to learn more about how you can do that, you just got to go to patreon.com, patreon.com/talknerdy to learn more. And of course, you can find access to some good perks there, including ad-free episodes of the show. This week, I had the opportunity to chat with a science and nature writer, Kristen Olson. She lives in Portland, Oregon. She's written several books, and she's written pieces for so many different outlets, the New York Times, Smithsonian, Discover, New Scientist, so many more. And she's also had her work anthologized in Best American Science Writing and Best American Food Writing, actually. But she's got a new book out, and it's called Sweet in Tooth and Claw, Stories of Generosity and Cooperation in the Natural World. So without any further ado, here she is, Kristen Olson. Well, Kristen, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's really great to talk to you.
I'm excited to talk about your newest book, and this is one of many, but this book is called Sweet in Tooth and Claw, Stories of Generosity and Cooperation in the Natural World. And of course, sweet in tooth and claw is not usually how we hear that phrase go. A little bit of a play on words there, but that's really the point, right? That's the whole point of the book.
It is the whole point of the book. You know, when I was doing the research for this book and you know, talking to various people, and that phrase, red in tooth and claw, nature is red in tooth and claw, kept coming up. And at a certain point, I thought, no, it's not red, it's sweet, or at least, you know, much of the time it's sweet. Of course, it is red sometimes. But, you know, that was a line that came out of a Tennyson poem from 175 years ago. And that line sort of fit very nicely into the thinking that was going around then about competition and nature being harsh and humans being outside of nature. And
What an important point. Yeah, this idea that we are somehow separate, and in some ways we have made ourselves quite separate, but this idea that there is an exceptionality to human beings, that we are somehow cognitively more capable of cooperation and nature is just violent and aggressive, really, you know, minimizes how sweet in tooth and claw nature is, but it also sort of ignores the fact that we ourselves are quite aggressive as a species.
Well, you know, I actually argue in the book that I argue against the idea that there's nature and that there's us, and I argue that we are part of nature, and that idea of you know, nature as being characterized by conflict and competition does spill over onto us. So that I think that we do take a view of ourselves as people who are unable to cooperate to get anything done. And in fact, we're an incredibly cooperative species. You know, I like to say our cities are marvels of cooperation. You know, we're probably more used to complaining about them. You know, we complain when there's rust in the water, or we complain when the traffic lights don't work. And, you know, we complain when all these, you know, marvelous inventions and marvelous accommodations that we've come up with don't work. But the fact is that we've, you know, got thousands and thousands and thousands of people crammed into cities, living together in cities. And it is a marvel of cooperation, you know, and I always love it in movies when somebody is walking along a street in a city and you hear a siren in the background. And that's like a cue. You're supposed to think, oh, it's dangerous here because there's a siren. And I always think, no, that's great. That means somebody is coming to help. You know, these helping behaviors are part of what living in a city is. So
I love your framing. I think it's wonderful. And it's true too, this idea that, like you mentioned, we always notice when things are not working, but that's because that's novel, right? Like everything is cooperative. Everything is like a fine-tuned machine. So when things break down, when things don't quite work the way we expect, that's when we become frustrated. That we take for granted how cooperative things are, how cooperative we are.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, when something goes wrong in your own body, you know, like if your knee starts to hurt, you're not used to thinking about your knee when you walk. You just walk. And I think it's the same way with these other things. You know, breakdown is sort of more novel. And so we complain about it and we pay attention to it. But in fact, we cooperate amazingly all the time.
So I'm curious what first got you interested in writing, not just about science, but specifically about science and nature.
You know, I think I always wanted to write about science and nature. You know, there were a lot of books that I read when I was a kid that were about science and archaeology and insects. And, you know, my parents, we lived in a really small town in the Sacramento Valley in California. And there was, to my recollection, there was not a single place that sold books, but there was a nice little library. And, you know, it was my parents compensated for the books that might not be available by joining me into all these, you know, kids' book clubs and stuff like that. So I read a lot when I was a kid, and I was always interested in science and nature. And I mean, it's interesting how you can think about how your life might have gone differently if only different influences were at work or different pathways open. But I, you know, I was really interested in observing nature when I was a kid. I was the youngest of, I am the youngest of five children, and the others are a lot older than I am. So they were off doing their thing. And, you know, my parents were off doing their thing. And there was a vacant lot with, I don't know, like 100 little ant hills in it, little ant homes in it. And I would go there and I would just spend hours there sort of watching them and, you know, dropping sugar, you know, to see how they would react to that, and dropping breadcrumbs and putting obstacles, you know, between the paths that they all traveled along. And, you know, and I'm sure I probably stepped on one and then watched to see what their its comrades did. So I was really fascinated with that. I was, you know, interested in birds and nature. So, you know, when you become a writer, then there becomes a whole different matter of how do you sell ideas? How do you work with editor? You know, how do you make the connections with editors that want that kind of thing? So it took me a while to figure that out.
Well, and also how do you make those ideas come to life, right? Because it's one thing as a kid to be observing the natural world, to be interrogating, investigating, engaging with the natural world independently or even at school. And it's another thing then to want to communicate these ideas to a public audience, which requires getting outside of yourself and going and interviewing experts and doing a lot of like legitimate journalism to get those ideas on the page.
Right. And that is so much fun. But you know, the gatekeeper there is the magazine or the, you know, that was what I was, when I was first starting to write, that was what I was working with, was magazine editors. And actually the first science piece that I ever wrote was something that an editor asked me to do. So I lived in Cleveland at that point, and it was a general interest magazine called The Gamut that largely looked at some of the work that local, well, it was produced by this one university, and it's sort of, but it wasn't an official organ of the university, but it did sort of look at the work that the scientists at that university were doing. And so, you know, the editor said, hey, you know, there's this theoretical physics experiment going on underneath Lake Erie. You want to write about that? And I was, yeah, sure. And it was this incredibly fascinating work that was going on with these physicists. Had this, you know, they went into underneath Lake Erie, which is right next to Cleveland. Underneath Lake Erie, there used to be all these massive salt mines, and those salt mines, the cavities are still there. And so these physicists had this project way down at the bottom of this abandoned salt mine, and they had this huge pond of water, and it was all surrounded by photo detectors, and they were trying to see if the photo detectors could pick up on the little flash of energy that would be emitted if a proton broke down. And it was something that I knew absolutely nothing about, and it was just fascinating. You know, I was pretty new to journalism then, and I didn't realize that tape recorders would often break. So I remember I had this long interview recorded with one of these scientists, and it didn't work. And I kept telling my friends, oh, I have a proton decay headache, you know, this massive headache, because it was all this information that I had lost.
Oh no. It's so funny that you, it's so funny that your entree was that, only because I want to say that the very last episode, or maybe it's 2 weeks ago now, I always time travel when I podcast because we slot things in at different times in the calendar. But we, I interviewed an accelerator physicist on the show. So we talked quite a lot about protons very recently. And like you, this was not my area of expertise, but it's been, it's always fascinating to learn about something that's so far outside of your normal experience. And as a kid observing nature, did you ever think that you would be getting to do a deep dive into something like this?
No, it never occurred to me. And that, you know, and that is the, you know, one of the great things about being a journalist, or what you do, is that you get to have these fascinating people doing amazing work, and then you can ask that, you're sort of given carte blanche to ask question after question after question after question until you exhaust your curiosity. That is such a pleasure.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to be able to be professionally curious, I think, is like one of the greatest gifts. And so you and I definitely share that. And one thing that I'm professionally curious about, and this is a little bit meta, but we'll get into the stories in the book very soon, is working with Patagonia as a publisher. Just looking at this book, it's like a stunning book. And I was reading that it's made, I think, completely out of recycled paper, or post-consumer paper. It's full, it's not just the words on the page, but it's full color imagery. And it's just, you know, it's a good, I guess, marriage between a classic book that you would sit down and read that's quite hearty, and also sort of a coffee table book that you want to display and you want people to pick up and look at.
Yeah, right. It is such a beautiful book. I mean, it's funny. I know that when I signed the contract, you know, when you have a book proposal, and you're, you know, and I have an agent, and she was trying to sell it to different publishers, and there was another publisher who was also interested in the book, and that publisher had recently announced that they were publishing the memoir of a really despicable person. I can't even remember his name, but he was really one of those. He was a despicable right-wing provocateur. And I was so sickened by that. And that was part of what steered me towards working with Patagonia. But, I think that when I signed the contract, I think I saw something in there about there being pictures, and I thought, well, if I thought anything about it at all, it was like, I hope they don't think I'm going to take the pictures, because I'm not really that good at that. And then when I finished writing the manuscript, and we fact checked it and did some editing and all that. And they said, oh, well, now it's time for us to work on the pictures. And I was like, wow, I have written a book that's going to have pictures. I hadn't tied all that together, but God, they did a fantastic job. It's a beautiful object.
It really is. I shouldn't say most, but a lot of the science writers that I know, and I've interviewed quite a few people on the show, and I also am lucky enough to have a fair amount of like friends and acquaintances who are science writers. They don't often get this opportunity to have this like full color, kind of beautiful creation. I don't know. You must be very proud. And this is by far not your first book. This is not your first rodeo.
It is not my first book. But, I think it really, I mean, it's been a great arrangement working with Patagonia. You know, I really respect their organizational ethics. I respect their mission. You know, they're not just about selling clothes. In fact, I think they sometimes get embarrassed about, selling stuff. That kind of appreciation and protection that they extend to the natural world, they also extend to the people who work with them and to each other. So it's been a really nice experience.
And of course, that's paralleled. I want to explore this concept of sort of natural history, observational, investigational science writing from a deeply naturalistic perspective. It's sort of in a modern world, we cannot really engage in that way without a conservation lens, can we? I mean, it almost feels dangerous to, or maybe I'm using strong language, but it almost feels like you're remiss, you're ignoring something, you're forgetting something if you celebrate in all of the beauty of nature without also including a conversation about what is happening to it and at our hands.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely true. And, and of course that is part of Patagonia's mission to draw attention to the very great dangers, that human activities pose to the natural world.
How do you handle that as a writer? How do you handle inspiring and instilling hope and wonder and awe and all of the things that, you know, as a little girl got you excited about writing and probably keep feeding you throughout your career with, you know, that balance of reverence and without getting too doom and gloom, which is always a risk when we sort of get into the conservation space?
You know, I think that for me, and especially as I worked on this book, you know, I'm just so bowled over with how much life our planet has. I mean, it just, you know, just bowled over by the amount of life that's underneath our fingernails and behind our ears. I mean, we're just swathed in life everywhere we turn. And, you know, the wonderful thing for me about working on this book was that I was able to talk to people who are working in a healing way with the natural world, and things heal really quickly. I mean, nothing is going to go back to the way it was before human intervention, you know, that because nature is so complex, you know, it's not going to have that same twist of the kaleidoscope that it had before, you know, humans went in and, you know, burn down a forest to build a city or something like that. But on the other hand, you know, there are just, I encountered story after story after story of people taking not even dramatically costly steps to restore a landscape that they knew that human activity had damaged. And by dialing back the damage, you know, these landscapes are now thriving. So it's pretty exciting to see that happening over and over again. And I, you know, it's it's something I have to keep, I have to remind myself of it, you know, every time I get a little panicked by something that I see going on.
Right. It's sort of the anchor for that hope.
Yeah. I mean, things really do bounce back. You know, I wrote about a stream in Oregon that somebody put a culvert over, over 60 years ago. You know, they put a road over a creek and put in a culvert so that the road could go over the creek. And it turned out right away that people figured out that, oh, this culvert is a bad thing because salmon are not able to migrate back up the stream. And it was not just that the creek was too high above the upper part of the creek was too high above the bottom part of the creek for the salmon to leap up, but also the culvert protected like stones and pieces of wood from tumbling through and creating good salmon habitat even below the culvert. So people had recognized this for a long time and like, oh, we should do something about this culvert. And finally, after 4 years of fundraising and a bunch of different groups got together again, they put in a culvert that allows this, you know, that changed all that and that allows the salmon to migrate. And so, you know, just within like a year, the salmon were back upstream and the Pacific lamprey, also another species, were back upstream, going up the creek and, you know, living up there, doing all the good things for the ecosystem that they do. And so, you know, it's now a very different ecosystem than it was before they changed out that. And that seems like a really minor thing. It was costly, but it was minor. And to know that those kinds of, those acts of healing are going on all over the place and, you know, that we can popularize the stories of them and that other people can try them too, you know, I think about that a lot.
Absolutely. I mean, it's something that's so salient in my mind just right now as being somebody who lives in Los Angeles. I mean, right now I'm on internship in Florida for the year, but LA is home. And we recently had Beth Pratt on the show to talk about the wildlife crossing that is being built like in the heart of this very, very busy city with, you know, 8-lane highways crisscrossing and so many of our mountain lines being lost to these traffic strikes that there's now this beautiful, stunning, and so important wildlife crossing being built over a portion of the highway that hopefully will make a huge impact on the connectivity of all of these different species in LA. And it's so cool to see people getting together. I mean, sadly, the tragedy is that our famous mountain lion P22 recently died, and a lot of people were getting together and celebrating his life recently. And so it's kind of around tragedy, but it's so cool to see, like you mentioned, these relatively simple solutions. Sure, sometimes they're costly, sometimes they're less costly. Sometimes they require a fair amount of engineering, and sometimes they're quite ingeniously simple, but how much of an impact they can really make.
Yeah, I just love that story of that animal crossing and all the others. You know, and sometimes I think people are doing this. It doesn't profit us directly, you know. Nobody's going to make money on it, but it is such an amazingly great thing that it's going on.
Oh, agree. And so now I'm curious about some of the amazingly great things that the different organisms, that the different ecosystems that you studied for your book are doing. Because I think I even mentioned it at the very beginning. We have this this view. And one of the places that I go kind of immediately to my mind is sort of like chimps and bonobos. They've become this caricature of sort of like the warring chimp and the peaceful sexual bonobo. And then we, as human beings, anthropomorphize them. But also we do the opposite, which is that we sort of, it's like we make them like us, but then we make ourselves like them. And oh, I see this aspect of me in the chimp, but not the bonobo, or this aspect of me in the bonobo, but not the chimp. And I'm just curious if this kind of binary thinking is something that you had to fight against when you were writing your book? This idea that's like good or bad, mean and aggressive or kind and cooperative. Like, is it really that simple?
And I think everything is a spectrum, you know, and even some of these tried and true mutualism. So a mutualism is a mutually beneficial relationship among two or more organisms. So even some of these mutualism. So I write a lot about mutualisms in the book. And the mutualism that probably most people see every day, or at least I hope most people see every day, is that between flowers and bees. You know, bees go in search of nectar, and they also want some pollen, and they, as they get their nectar, they pollinate, you know, they pick up pollen and they move it around, and it's like a third party mating among flowers. But one of the things that I thought was so funny is that some scientists are studying how some bees cheat in that mutualism, that instead of coming in through the top of the flower, which is the right way to do it, you know, what we call the right way to do it, so that they pick up pollen and move it around. Some of these bees, if they're a little too fat and the blossom is a little too narrow, they'll chew a hole in the side and get the nectar that way. So there are, of course, many funny stories and many permutations of behavior. And I think there are also situations where, like, there's a mutualism between ants and aphids in many ecosystems, where ants sort of like they're the original cattle herders. They're the original cowboys. They have these aphids and they keep them there and they milk them for their sweet liquid. But if things change, you know, they milk the aphids, and then the aphids have a safe place to be. But if the things change in the ecosystem, if things change for the ants, sometimes they will just like eat that herd, you know, sacrifice that herd. So those, you know, those relationships among living things are somewhat dynamic, and changes that, you know, I always get a little concerned about big changes that we make in ecosystems and how those changes might affect, the mutualisms that keep those ecosystems going. I even think about it in quirky ways too. You know, when I'm out walking my dog at night and I walk past somebody's house where they have a dryer going, and what is blowing out the dryer vent is this highly perfumed hot air. And I sort of think, you know, all these microorganisms that run the world, you know, they communicate with each other through chemicals. Well, what are those chemicals telling them to do? How are we changing even this little ecosystem in my neighborhood by spewing out those kinds of stinky chemicals?
Right. And also so fascinatingly, I mean, sometimes unfortunately, but sometimes very fortunately, we'll so often see a almost resiliency in nature, an adaptability in nature, where there will be whole ecosystems that will be built up around some sort of human-induced change, like these microcosmic populations. I would not be surprised if there is a drier vent ecology, you know what I mean, out there.
And that is probably true. I remember interviewing a scientist a couple of years ago who was studying microorganisms on the ocean floor, looking at them around where there were gas or oil seeps in the ocean floor. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, you know, there's just really a lot of microorganisms there that eat oil. I mean, it blows up that population, just like it blows up the population of microbes in our gut, you know, when we eat certain things. If we start to eat a lot of celery and, you know, very fibrous vegetables, that bumps up that population of microbes that are in our gut that feed on that.
Absolutely. And so many of the things that we do in the world as human beings, whether it be building infrastructure or whether it be engaging in practices that are, you know, necessary for our survival, like farming, for example, dramatically changes the landscape. It doesn't have to dramatically change the landscape in the ways that it has historically done. There are innovative practices. And when I say innovative, very often the innovation is actually to stop innovating and to actually try and learn from indigenous practices, right? To get it out of our own way and try to understand the way that individuals lived harmoniously with nature for so long. But in your book, you didn't shy away from engaging and speaking, like for example, to farmers about their own experiences.
Oh yeah, I mean, there is a really, it's hard to think of something that affects land more than our farming, our agriculture, and most of it is just terrible. And it's kind of funny because I as I said, I used to live in Cleveland, but my family was on the West Coast, and I made lots of cross-country drives to go out and visit my, and I used to love driving through the Midwest where there would be, you know, those beautiful, what seemed to me beautiful then, these beautiful fields, you know, like unfurling on either side of the highway with these rows of corn going off.
The amber waves of grain.
And then the brown earth between them. And I used to just think that was so beautiful. And now I just know that that is so horrible, you know, that is this simplification of a natural landscape that we have imposed there, where we've got a monoculture, you know, one thing being grown for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of acres. And that is so antithetical to the way nature is. You know, nature can have 200 different plants in a square yard. So that, you know, having a monoculture growing like that for hundreds, thousands of acres is so damaging. The way that pristine, empty row between those corn plants is maintained with chemicals and tillage, such a damaging practice. I mean, everything in that landscape that I used to love, I now know is a killer. But I think what's really exciting is that there are farmers all over the world who are working on changing that. And a lot of them started, of course, because they were struggling financially with that model of agriculture. You know, they were spending a tremendous amount of money on chemicals. They were spending a tremendous amount of money on gasoline and machinery. They were spending a tremendous amount of money on, you know, these high-tech hybrid seeds, and they were going broke, and they were fighting with the weather. You know, they had this landscape that was not even slightly resilient to, you know, all the weird weather that we have now. So in my last book was called The Soil Will Save Us, but in this book I have a whole chapter about what is called regenerative agriculture, where farmers are really trying, not instead of simplifying the landscape to make it easy for their machines, they are trying to work with the complex, they are trying to replicate the complexity of nature. So they're not, if they have a field of corn, they will have, instead of those empty rows between the corn, they'll have all these other plants growing there that are both feeding the soil microorganisms underneath, you know, underneath those, all those crops. And, you know, that is a mutualism that, is what grows plants. But they're also, you know, making sure that there are a lot of flowering plants in there between those, their crop plants, so that they are attracting beneficial insects, and they are, pulling back or completely eliminating the pesticides and the herbicides and even the fertilizers. So there really is a fabulous worldwide movement of farmers to change that Western, and it's not even that old, you know, it just goes back to like the you know, the middle of the last century. It's not like it's, you know, we call that conventional agriculture, but it hasn't been conventional for that long. And so these farmers are looking to indigenous practices. They're looking to the work of scientists who are looking at complexity in nature and who are studying the interactions between soil microorganisms and plants. It's pretty exciting stuff. And I think it has the potential to really, change so many of the, you know, to affect so many of the things that we worry about. For one thing, carbon. I mean, that was the thing that attracted me at first to writing about this because so much carbon is lost from soils when under conventional farming, you know, when we till and all the carbon that's been built up in the soil because of that interaction between plants and soil microorganisms for millions of years, that carbon is lost in conventional agriculture. In fact, there's been 115 billion tons of carbon lost from soils, especially in the last 200 years. So I was initially attracted to this, you know, to writing about this kind of agriculture because I thought, wow, they're putting carbon back in the soils. You know, they're not tilling. They're trying to have as many roots in the soil as possible so that I haven't even gone into my whole big thing, but you know, photosynthesis, we know photosynthesis, plants have their solar panels up there, which are their leaves, and they are taking carbon dioxide out of the air and converting that into a carbon fuel, which is their fuel source. And they're making this carbon fuel to grow their own their stalks and their flowers and their leaves and all and their roots and all of that. But they also exude 40% or more of that carbon fuel through their roots to microorganisms in the soil that are bringing them services in payment in exchange for this carbon fuel. So that's how that carbon got in the soil in the first place. And there's just thousands of farmers around the world who are now figuring out ways to emphasize plants getting out there and getting, you know, pulling in that carbon dioxide, making sure that the soil is healthy with plenty of microorganisms so that plants are feeding them with their roots. It's pretty exciting. So that kind of agriculture, I think, is going to make a big difference as it keeps getting bigger. It's going to make a big difference in terms of our concerns about carbon, because that is, you know, instead of farmlands being a carbon source, they can become much more of a carbon sink. But also that kind of agriculture that encourages not just healthy soil, but biodiversity. You know, conventional farming is it does all it can to get rid of biodiversity, but this other kind of agriculture tries to bring as much biodiversity into farmlands as it can. And that makes a big difference for all the wildlife that we worry about, you know, the insects and the birds and the small mammals and the bigger mammals. You know, if we are raising our food on these vast monocultures that are laden with killing chemicals, then there's no place for the insects and the birds and the small mammals. But in these farms, this sort of new model of farm, it's an oasis for those creatures.
Well, you know, what's funny is that I feel like this is a sort of, I don't want to call it, it's the theme. It's really the point, right? It's not a parallel or a metaphor. It's sort of the whole point of the book as you are writing about mutualisms and cooperation and generosity within these different, species, within these different organisms throughout different ecosystems. you're also drawing this, like I said, it's not really a parallel, it's sort of the overarching theme, but you're drawing this, our attention to the fact that we are also mutualistic, or we could be better at being mutualistic with this environment. We are a part of the landscape, and clearly we have been extractive and colonial, and we have been doing things to the landscape that are so detrimental and disruptive. But if we can be that detrimental and disruptive and destructive, we can also be kind and cooperative to the landscape. We have that capability.
Yeah, we absolutely have that capability. We are, you know, we're an incredibly creative species and an incredibly cooperative one. You know, sometimes we cooperate to do very bad things, but as you pointed out, you know, with the wildlife crossing in Los Angeles, we can also be creative and cooperative and do really great things. And I think, you know, I think that we are at a sort of a, you know, a come to Jesus moment with our relationship with the rest of the natural world. You know, we see all these crises. We have, you know, crisis of weather and so many things that we are concerned about. And also at the same time, there are all these scientists who are studying mutually beneficial relationships. And I think that that not only their, not only the individual discoveries that each of them make, but the movement of thought turning towards how does everything work together? How does everything support each other? I mean, that is a great scientific moment, but it's also a great cultural moment. And I think a lot of those messages are going out via various people. You know, I'm always really happy. I was really happy to see, I can't even remember where I read it yesterday, but somebody was talking about, oh, I think because she had an article in the, she had an essay or an interview in the New York Times, Robin Wall Kimmerer. And I remember when her book, Braiding Sweetgrass, first came out, and, you know, it was so easy to get it at the library. And I thought, wow, nobody's reading this? Well, now everybody's reading it. And, you know, she is a really amazing voice for this new but old movement of looking at the rest of nature as our brother and sister and relatives, and looking at how we have to respect and work with instead of dominate and conquer.
Why is it so hard for us to shift our perspective in that way? You know, why do you think that there is such a struggle? Because there's still so many people on the planet who might roll their eyes at that conversation or that ask, that when we say things like extractive or dominating or colonial, are like, ugh, give me a break. And it's heartbreaking. I've tried to have this conversation with some people, and it's like we can't even meet at the table.
Yeah, I think part of, you know, I think part of it is that, I think part of it is that that people have the idea that to respect and support the rest of nature, that means that we have to give up a lot ourselves. And I think it does mean that we have to give up some things. But I think that, you know, there is room for both. There is, like, I love the example of Singapore, which is a city that I wrote about in my book, which is kind of like the poster child for this group called, biophilic cities, you know, life-loving cities. And Singapore, you know, 50 years ago, Singapore decided to reconceive itself as a garden city. And now they're extending that concept to it being a city in nature. So they've known for a long time that cities that welcome the rest of nature, you know, especially the plants, are going to be more pleasant for humans. You know, they're going to be more resilient in bad weather. They're going to, you know, cities that have a lot of greenery protect people against heat to a dramatic extent. So Singapore now has, you know, so they're just greening things like crazy there. They now have 350 parks and also 225 miles of park connectors so that people can get from one park to another. And they're, you know, they're emphasizing growing greenery up the buildings and having green roofs. And it's kind of like amazing because as the city has increased its human population, it has also increased the green cover. So you would think that it would be an either or. You can either have nature, that kind of nature, or you can have people, but they're showing that you can have both. And not only can you have both, not only can cities be a refuge for insects and birds and small mammals and sometimes even bigger mammals, which many people find disconcerting.
I think it's wonderful.
I do too. But those cities are then so much more habitable for humans. You know, they handle water better. They handle heat better. You know, just all of that stuff. They handle pollution better. You know, back to the regenerative farms that I was talking about before, you know, so a lot of these regenerative farmers, so when they're raising, say, corn as their main crop, when they're raising corn that way, they might not have the yield that a farmer down the road who's using a lot of chemicals, they might not have quite the yield. Sometimes they do, sometimes they have more, but sometimes they don't. But they do what they call stacking enterprises. So that means that when they grow a field of corn, then after they harvest that corn, they route their cattle and their other animals through that field so that the cattle and the sheep and the chickens and all that, they can sort of mow down all that vegetation that's there. So they have a product that's meat and eggs and all of that. And then they have, you know, then sometimes they have other, you know, they'll put hives out there. So they have honey, but they call this stacking enterprises. You know, that's how they make a good living, is that they stack enterprises. And I think we kind of have to do that wherever we are, you know, even if we're, say we're making a housing development, you know, we still have to think about stacking enterprises there, like stacking the human enterprise and stacking the rest of, you know, having, always having an allowance and an accommodation and a welcome mat for the rest of nature there too, so that birds can thrive in that housing development and insects can thrive and, you know, all of that. I think we just really have to change the way that we think of the landscapes that we inhabit so that they are not only good for us, but they have to be good for the rest of nature too.
Have you ever seen, there's a cartoon, or maybe I should call it like a comic strip. And of course, I'm trying to find it right now. I feel like it's called The Fence. And it just comes to mind. It's this beautiful kind of image of the earth. And it starts out with a little tiny fence. And it says, you know, we call it a fence. It's there to protect us from the elements or from, you know, the predators, from nature. And then as it there's like multiple frames of this cartoon. Oh, I found it. And so you've got this green, really beautiful thing with a tiny fence. We call it a fence. It keeps out the giraffes and the lions and the elephants. And then, you know, cut to further in time and you've got just this like barren wasteland on one side of the fence and greenery on the other. And then the greenery keeps shrinking and shrinking. And finally it says, we call it a wildlife preserve. It keeps in the giraffes and the lions and the elephants. And it really is this stunning realization when you look at a cartoon like this of our perception, because so much of it is perspective, right? And perception that like we are somehow separate and that we have to we have had to build infrastructure to protect us from nature. But now there is so much infrastructure, it has taken over the whole world, that we are now having to protect nature from us.
Right, right.
And it's heartbreaking to think about.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, and we have to change our idea of infrastructure and our cities.
Right. And like you were mentioning before, what is good for other organisms is also good for us. Like when we are building, when we are engaging, these questions about can we be resilient? Can we adapt to shifts in climate? Can we adapt to shifts in water depth? Can we adapt to, like, where does the water go when it rains? All of these questions that I worry, I mean, historically, we just didn't care about. We were just like, build here. We'll be fine. Screw everything else. It's like we were lacking the forethought.
Yeah. I remember I had a very lovely father-in-law. He's dead now, but very, very, very lovely man, you know, just cared about, you know, he was an old socialist, so he cared about people deeply. But I remember one time we were sitting by a lake or something like that, and he took something out of a package and he threw the paper in the water. And I was like, what? What are you doing? And he said, oh, do you know how much, I think it must have been by the ocean. He said, do you know how much water there is? You know, do you know how big it is? It's just so immense that this just doesn't make any difference. And I think, you know, he was of a generation that could have that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they had the privilege to have that perspective. Yeah.
They had the privilege to have that uh-huh. perspective. We now know that that is just a deadly perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know, this view, I mean, I think sometimes there's some merit when you hear people who have had a perspective shift who say things like, we are not destroying the planet. In essence, like, yes, we are causing immeasurable damage, but like the planet will survive. We are destroying our ability to exist on this planet. But I think sometimes, yes, that is true. And I think it's important to emphasize that, but it's not just us. We're taking a lot of stuff down with us. And that's the really, really devastating part.
You know, I wanted to get back to what you were saying before about people being cynical about, you know, about all of this. And I think a lot of it is that people just don't know a way to do things better, you know, so then they became like, they become like, no, nothing could change. Blah, blah, blah. So the chapter in my book about the ranchers in Nevada, I think is so instructive. So here are these ranchers that had been doing, grazing their animals in the way that their ancestors had done and their ancestors before them had done, which is just by letting them out into the landscape. This is in eastern Nevada, letting them out into the landscape and letting them do whatever they wanted. And then, you know, they'd have them out there for, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 months and then bring them back in the winter. And there were some scientists who were studying the local trout populations in the creeks around there. And the creeks were getting sicker and sicker. You know, there wasn't any vegetation around them. The cows would eat the vegetation around the creeks, and their hooves would sink down into the mud and damage the roots. So these creeks were in a really degraded state, and the water was too warm, and the local trout were suffering. And so these scientists went to a group of ranchers and said, you know, we want to see if you can do things, if we can figure out a way to do things differently. We want these creeks to be healthier so these trout can survive. And a lot of these ranchers were like, you know, these creeks have always been like this. These creeks have always, you know, they dry up in the middle of every hot summer. They've always been like this. But they were persuaded, you know, because they were, these scientists were connected with some of the government agencies that allow them to use public lands for their cattle. So they were, you know, mindful of, you know, getting along with these agencies. So they, yes, will try to do things differently. So they started to graze their cattle differently. They wouldn't let them just hang out at the creeks all summer long. They would let them there, go there like early in the summer, and then have to put in fences to keep the cattle away from the creeks. And, you know, and they were kind of sure that this was just a big pain in the ass for them and that it wasn't really going to make much difference anyway. And then, you know, they were sort of interested when things started to change, you know, when grasses and reeds and more things started to grow up along the sides of the creeks, and willows started to grow there. And then they were feeling kind of proud of themselves that, you know, here are this new vegetation was coming up along the creeks. And then the beaver showed up. So beavers have, you know, I mean, we of European ancestry have had such a bad history with beaver in the United States. You know, the old fur traders slaughtered so many of them. I mean, they were the reason that our lands from coast to coast were so well watered and green to begin with, and then we slaughtered so much of them. Anyway, there was a population of beaver that was nearby, and they came into this area and they started to build dams and they started to completely change the landscape. You know, the beavers would build a dam and a pond would form behind the dam, and the actual water table of this area started to change. And this part of the desert changed from being just a dry, gravelly desert where there was only sagebrush to something that's much more like a wetland. And, you know, it's now habitat for birds and insects and other mammals. It means that the water table is high enough so that grasses grow far from the creeks, so for the cattle to eat. It means that there are fewer fires there. It's just been an amazing change on the landscape. Now, none of those ranchers, I don't even know if the scientists anticipated this, that this fairly small change, although the ranchers would probably argue that it wasn't that small of a change. But nobody likes to change what they're doing. But it was in the scheme of things, it was a pretty small change, and it dramatically changed that landscape. So that was a stunning story for me because it showed how regeneration can take place even in a really degraded landscape where nobody expected it. But it also really changed things for these ranchers, you know, from being people who would sort of say, well, you know, we can't do that. That's not going to work. It's always been like this, to being people who are excited about the possibility and excited about the ecology on their land. So
right.
I think that
the proof is like in the pudding. Like, you know, they had to try.
They had
and that
to
was
try
the hard part.
And
mm-hmm.
there had to be a possibility for there had to be an opportunity for them to do something that made a difference. And I don't think enough people are given that opportunity to do something that makes a difference. And I think that people who scoff would be far less full of scoff if they could participate in something that makes a difference, that's especially something that's that dramatic.
Right, because it's quite empowering. It's meaningful for an individual. It gives a strong sense of purpose and self-efficacy and engagement. And the funny thing, once again, kind of coming back to these beautiful, wonderful stories that you tell in your book, is that all we're really asking to do here, all we're really trying to do, is in some ways to emulate, to learn from these different organisms, these different species that you so beautifully write about, because their cooperation, their engagement, their generosity, their mutualism is what makes the landscape. It's what makes these ecologies so resilient and so adaptable. And that's all we're trying to do, is to not be so rigid and to start being more resilient and more adaptable by being cooperative with the landscape.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, we've been talking now for about an hour. It's like so easy for me to just go. I'm curious before, I have some closing questions that I always ask, but before we even get to that, obviously there's so many stories in the book that you tell. We had a little tiny sampling with a couple of them here, but I'm curious if there's anything that we didn't really cover that you feel like, oh, you know, we can't go without mentioning this. And if not, that's okay.
I love all these stories. there was a story of, I just love all these stories. I get excited about all of them. I get excited about the people in cities around the world that are trying to make, make cities more welcoming of the rest of nature. There was a really sweet story in the book about this organic farm in Costa Rica. And it was an organic farm, which meant that it didn't use the kind of scary chemicals that conventional farms do. But it was still a farm that was sort of in the mold of those big monoculture cornfields. They had things growing in a row and dirt between them and all that. And they thought they were doing a good job until they had a scientist come in and look at their soil. And they were shocked to find out that their soil was really low in carbon and low in biodiversity of the soil microorganisms. And so they completely changed things. Instead of growing things in a row, it's sort of like they grow things in a swirl. They planted hundreds and hundreds of native trees, including, I think, 100 different fruit trees. And they now are growing things so that there's no bare ground anywhere, but it's all this swirl of vegetation. And it is just an amazing place. So now they are, they're harvesting different crops than they did before, but they're harvesting crops. But also because they put in all that, those extra plants that weren't there before, they're having there's just like an explosion of insects and birds and mammals there that even the local people had not seen in generations. So it's become a birding hotspot, and that's why I know about it. So it was just a really remarkable change. And it's a change on that land that radiates, throughout the countryside. It's if there's that habitat where birds and insects and animals are flourishing, it benefits the area around it. There are just so many stories like that in the book, and I love telling them.
And we love hearing them. And so I'm curious, towards the end of every episode, I always ask my guests the exact same two questions, but my guests come from all different walks of life within all different, generally science, but science, social justice, psychology kind of perspectives. And so I'm going to be really curious about your answers. And you may have already answered these questions throughout the show, so it's fine if you have. We can just kind of revisit, or maybe you have a different answer altogether. But they're sort of big picture. So I'm curious, when you think about the future, and that can be in whatever context feels relevant to you, obviously there are contexts that are brought about by your writing, but we all have our own kind of personal engagements, families, communities, cultures. It could be national, it could be global, it could be cosmic. So the first thing I'm curious about is, when you think about the future, what is keeping you up the most at night? Where are you finding that you are struggling maybe with pessimism or cynicism, and that you are really, legitimately concerned? And then on the flip side of that, where are you finding your hope and your optimism in an authentic way, not like a Pollyanna way, but where are you authentically and truthfully, or what I should say, are you looking forward to?
Well, it doesn't take much to keep me up at night. I'm kind of an insomniac. but I, the thing that the trend that disturbs me right now, and I'm sure it's only going to grow in the future, is for venture capitalists working with certain kinds of scientists to sort of de-biologize the world, you know, to figure out how to grow meat in a lab, you know, grow, come up with all these ways of growing food for people that has nothing to do with the natural world. So I find that really
disturbing for you. Okay. All right.
I find that really disturbing, you know, because that's a lot of money and money is always looking for a place to grow. And, you know, and I think that, that's one place that, it's growing and it disturbs me. And what gives me hope, you know, it's all the stuff that I wrote about in the book. It's, you know, the scientists who are doing this great work, discovering how everything is connected, everything is, supporting each other. I mean, of course, conflict and competition goes on, but really what holds the world together, what shapes the world is these cooperative relationships. And I, you know, we do a lot of fretting about how terrible the internet can be and how terrible social media can be. But, you know, where I'm paying attention to it, I see people linking up with each other to figure out how to fix things. Oh, and, you know, here's another thing that I didn't even mention before, but I think it's a really powerful trend, is this trend for solutions journalism. I don't know if you heard that phrase. Yeah. So I think, I think for a long time, people in media and, you know, probably myself included would think, oh, you know, that's the job of news media. It's to report about all the terrible things that are going on.
Right.
So that yeah. We know what's going on. And of course, the news media does have to have that function. But I think that there was always sort of a holding one's nose at the idea that the media should tell positive stories, you know, that was just kind of a pablum for babies who weren't ready to face the problems of the real world. And I think that there's a trend now that's pushing against that and saying, no, people also need to know solutions. I mean, it doesn't help just to know the problems. In fact, just knowing the problems makes people freeze up and become cynical. But there is, you know, like Berkeley, I know Berkeley has a program of solutions journalism, and I see more and more outlets that are focusing on these, you know, articles about how people have figured out how to do something right, whether it's in their cities or on their farms or, you know, in their families. And I think that is a really positive trend because people are doing things right all the time. We just don't necessarily hear about them. But I love it that there is this movement now within journalism to popularize those stories.
Absolutely. Well, everyone, the book is Sweet in Tooth and Claw, Stories of Generosity and Cooperation in the Natural World. I just want to thank Kristen Olson. Thank you so much for being here with us, for continuing to write the stories that you write and draw attention to the issues that you do, and for sharing with us in this hour today.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a fun conversation.
Yeah, I agree. And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy. Mm-hmm.